Welcome to Speak Up, the official podcast of Speech Pathology Australia. We bring you insightful conversations with leading professionals about key issues and innovations in speech pathology, all in a concise format that's perfect for your busy schedule. We aim to inform, inspire, and also engage. We love hearing from you, so please join the conversation on our social media platforms or email us with your thoughts and questions. And please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues. Your support helps us grow and inform, inspire and engage others. Now, let's embark on today's conversation.
My name is Marlene Westerveld and I'm an Associate Professor in Speech Pathology at Griffith University on the Gold Coast, in Queensland, situated on the lands of the Kumbamari families of the Yugambeh language region. So today, I am joined by Dr. Sonia Brubaker. Sonia is an adjunct senior research fellow at the Center for Investigative Interviewing at Griffith University, situated on the lands of the Yugurubu, Jugara, and Turrbal peoples. Thank you so much for joining me today, Sonia. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you and find out a little bit more about the work you do. So today we really get to explore how we can ask better questions in healthcare. So before we get into that, I actually want to ask you a little bit more about investigative interviewing and the work that you and your colleagues do at the Center for Investigative Interviewing. When I hear the term investigative interviewing, I actually think of the criminal justice system and not necessarily the health or education sector.
Certainly, absolutely. When we talk about investigative interviewing, that's what most people think about. And in fact, a lot of our work does relate to the criminal justice system, to police and child protection, and those who interview other vulnerable people. But investigative interviewing, if you think about it more broadly, it can be a conversation or an interview to find out what happened, to gather information. So there are a lot of settings in which we gather information. We may gather information in educational settings about, simply how students are doing, things that are going on at home, bullying incidents and other internal complaints. We may gather information in healthcare as well. When medical professionals are talking to patients about experiences that they've had, let's say dizzy spells or anxiety attacks, when those are happening and their contexts and their surroundings. And also for speech pathologists as well, which I'm sure we're going to talk about.
That's right. Yeah. So what's some of the work that you do at the center? Because I understand that you do quite a bit of training, and we'll definitely get into that. But I also understand that you do research projects. So I don't know if you want to sort of explain a little bit more about that as well.
Yeah, we do research and training mostly hand in hand, although sometimes we do some research that's just on its own for the sake of finding things out. But a lot of what we do involves training interviewers, or I shouldn't always use the term interviewers, but training professionals who are gathering information to ask questions that are effective in eliciting information that's both complete and accurate. So we do that training work, and then we also do research related to the training work, research not only on the content of the training, the what should be trained, but also on how to train, mostly how to train adults in such a way that they retain the skills over the long term. So we've done a number of studies looking at different elements of training, of interactivity, immediate feedback, and all of that research feeds into the courses that we deliver and gives us some insight into, what order activities might be best done in, how to scaffold the learning in a way that it promotes sort of more deep, enduring learning of concepts and that people are retaining the skills longer after they're completing the courses.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And I think speech pathologists will definitely be interested in that because we're very proud of the fact that we are really sort of evidence-based practitioners. So, so thank you for those insights. So I want to know what your thoughts are about sort of how might this be particularly relevant for speech pathologists. Are you able to expand on that a little bit more? Because we're talking about healthcare more broadly, you've said sort of, the police and people who work in the criminal justice system. You've sort of mentioned healthcare professionals in general. What about speech pathologists? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think my perception of it is that it's more relevant for speech pathologists in terms of helping people construct narratives than information gathering. So the speech pathologists work to talk to children or perhaps adults with various language difficulties and challenges, maybe to invite a narrative account. But by us training sort of different ways to use open-ended questions, which are questions that allow flexible responses and invite sort of lengthy responses, by us training how to use those questions in different kinds of ways, how to help people use those questions to scaffold the narrative, I think they can be useful for speech pathologists in just getting more and more richer information. And maybe it's best expressed as helping the child or the client to provide as much information as they really are capable of. It sort of maximizes, these types of questions may maximize their ability to provide a narrative account.
And that's an interesting concept, isn't it? Because I think most of our listeners will be familiar with eliciting narratives, mainly for assessment purposes. And then interestingly, we actually always tell our speech pathologists, do not provide any guidance, you know, don't give them any scaffolding, because what we want to do is we want to see what do people actually, what can they do without support? And what can they, yeah, we look at the structure of their narratives, we look at the cohesion, you know, we look at their topic maintenance, we look at how much detail they give. So to me, it sounds like we can still do that. You know, I don't want our listeners to think, have we been doing that wrong? Or have I been teaching it wrong? But it's definitely what's really nice to hear. And we're going to delve into that a little bit deeper to how can we actually support people. You know, once we've got that sort of baseline, how can we actually support people or children in providing more detailed, better narratives? What can we do to support that? So hopefully that makes sense to you and to all our listeners to see, okay, how does it complement our skills? Because yes, you're absolutely right. We love narratives.
and I will also clarify, and so thank you for pointing that out. I agree. I think you certainly can do both. So we also train in our, you know, in our courses, in our healthcare course, and in our investigative interviewing courses more broadly, that initial invitation or first invitation, initial narrative prompt, the kind of tell me everything that happened, start from the beginning. It may be worded differently for different professional groups, but that first invitation is the one where we really hope. I'm going to give you a criminal justice example because that's sort of where I come from and that's my expertise area. But if we can get a child to provide a really nice narrative to that first open-ended prompt, that is the response that we have the most faith in the interview. So from the perspective of analyzing the interview and the child's evidence and considering what they have given us, that first response is really key. So to me, that's kind of the same as what you're talking about in speech pathology. That first response is what will give you your baseline. Then, you know, I'm not as familiar with, you know, the profession of speech pathology. I've just learned from talking with you and from you know, reading the research, but it's not my main area of expertise. But I see that as being then the next step. So we understand what they're capable of producing, but then with added support, with scaffolding, what more can they do? And that can be a kind of training exercise in a way for the client.
That's right. Yeah. So now let's get into the sort of the mechanics of this a little bit further, because you've talked about or you've mentioned open-ended questions. And one of the things that I always come across is, you know, when I talk to teachers or talk to psychologists such as you or talk to, you know, other professionals, that we always use the same terminology, but we use it in different ways. So let's sort of put it out there, you know, what's your sort of definition of open-ended questions? So what are they and what are they not, I suppose?
Mm-hmm. The definition that we use in the Center for Investigative Interviewing and in our training courses and our research is that open-ended questions are the type that elicit or that encourage elaborate responses. And they also don't dictate what the content of the response should be. So they don't tell the respondent what exact information or what topic specifically they should provide. Instead, they allow for a flexible response. So they allow a respondent. So for example, tell me what happened is our kind of classic open-ended question. A person can talk about a small part of the event, a large part of the event. They can talk about, you know, their thoughts and feelings related to the event and a variety of experiences. So those are the kind of classic open-ended questions. Now, so in some literature, and particularly in some areas of psychology, in investigative interviewing, usually with adult witnesses, some people also consider the sort of WH or interrogative questions as open-ended. We do not. So we don't consider the WH questions, the who, what, when, where, why, and how questions, as open-ended because they don't tend to encourage a lengthy response. And they are also very specific on the content of that response. So if I say, you know, when did you go to the park? I'm telling that respondent I want to know sort of temporal information. And I'm constraining them to that kind of a response. Now, WH questions are recall questions, like open-ended questions. And so they do have that positive element of you know, getting somebody to report the information in their words and of the person producing the response themselves. But according to our definitions of the response flexibility and the elaboration, they don't fit the definition of open-ended questions.
Okay, so give me a few more examples. So you're okay. Asking me, you know, what happened this morning? And I say, I went to the park.
So then I might follow up with what we call, so we divide our open-ended questions into two main categories. There are sort of a few other types, but the two primary categories are the breadth prompt and the depth prompt. So a breadth prompt would be if I ask you to sort of provide the sequence of events or the elements of the events, the sub-events. I like to think about it like a comic strip, the old-fashioned comic strip. So breadth prompts get you those pictures in the comic strip. And then depth prompts dive in deeper to information that has been provided about the sub-events. So that's like taking a picture from the comic strip and going into that picture and asking about that mini part of the event. So if you said you went to the park this morning, there's not a whole lot there for me to start with. So I might just ask you a breadth question. So I might say, you know, tell me what happened when you got to the park or when you first got to the park or what happened next. So you might tell me you sat on a bench and you watched some birds, and I'll say, okay, tell me about the part where you were sitting on the bench. So that's a depth prompt. So now we're taking something that you've mentioned and trying to get some more elaboration on it. And so by using the depth and breadth prompts, and there's really no right way or wrong way of using them. Some people like to use a whole bunch of breadth prompts and get an overall picture of the event and then go back and use depth prompts to get more elaboration on all of the parts. And other people like to work back and forth. And I think it depends on your own personal style and also the event that the respondent is sharing.
Yeah, no, thank you. That's definitely much clearer. And I think there are a couple of ways I think that speech pathologists could be using this. One, of course, would be in their perhaps in their interventions, because I think it's always good to have more sort of tools in your toolbox, if you like, and to really, it's about reflective practice. It's about looking at your own way of asking questions. And I actually did the training course for children. And I must say, it's been a real eye opener. Yeah, just looking at my own way of questioning and looking at the types of open-ended questions. So that's definitely been a good learning curve for me. But the other thing that I think about is, for example, when I did the course or when you read about investigative interviewing, is about sort of children who are witnesses. So we're talking about vulnerable populations and children who might have been subject to abuse. So why is it important in those cases that you're asking the right questions?
Well, it's important in those cases to make sure, if it's an investigation, to make sure that you're getting the most accurate information that you can and that you're not contaminating the account in any way. So, you know, if it's an investigation and somebody is potentially could be charged with a crime, open-ended questions tend to be responded to more accurately than any other type of question. The reason is because they're recall questions. So they require that the respondent produce a response rather than agree with an interviewer, like a yes, no question. And also because they're broader compared to, you know, a WH question like what season was it or, you know, what were you wearing? Those narrower questions, although children do say they, you know, I don't know to those questions more so than to yes, no questions. There is recent research showing that kids have a tendency to guess to those WH questions, particularly when they have the domain knowledge. So if I ask, you know, what season was it? Even if a child doesn't really know, they may know their seasons. And so it's easy to produce a response to that question. So we do get, we get the most guessing and acquiescence errors to sort of yes, no, and forced choice questions like, you know, was it spring or summer? But then we get to still get a sort of a medium amount of guessing with these WH questions, particularly when the child possesses the domain knowledge. So time, colors, as another example, clothing items. And so the open-ended questions are really the most likely to get that accurate information. And so, you know, from an investigation standpoint, we need it to be accurate. The other thing is open-ended questions tend to be simpler in wording. They tend not to involve as much jargon. That's not to say they can't, somebody can't put a, you know, a hard word in an open-ended question, but they're mainly, you know, what happened next? Tell me what happened. You said something in the child's words. Tell me about that. So there's not a lot of opportunity to introduce difficult words. And we really want to make sure when we're talking to vulnerable people that we are using simple, straightforward language so that the concepts are clear and easy to understand. And then those open-ended questions put that control of the interview in the hands of the interviewee, in the hands of the respondent. The respondent is choosing what information to provide. So that may be also more, it's sort of more trauma-informed. It's more supportive.
Yeah, that's very clear. Thank you. I just want to sort of bring it back to clinical practice. And for most of our listeners, they'll know that I work with children. So many of my questions are around children, but we'll get back to adults in a minute. So often what we find, and I just wanted your feedback or thoughts on this, what we find when we're eliciting personal narratives from children. So I'm a strong believer in eliciting personal narratives. So asking children, you know, tell me a story about a time you were happy, or tell me a story about a time you were angry, or tell me a time that you went to the beach and what happened, which is very much in line with the kind of narratives that you are talking about. And then I really like using it as a context for intervention as well. Now, what we often get from children is that, you know, you might say to them, okay, tell me a time that, and they say, I don't remember. And there is some literature to suggest that some children really can't remember because it's too long ago or it doesn't stand out, it wasn't extra special. Some children might do it because they don't want to talk about it. So I'm just wondering, you know, do you have sort of any suggestions or any research to refer to that gives us a little bit more information around sort of the memory component about how recent does an event need to be? How much does it need to stand out? Does it have to be a standalone event or does it have to be a recurrent event? Any thoughts on that I would really appreciate.
Yeah, I would be happy to. And in fact, children's autobiographical memory development is actually that was where I started my research career. So I love to talk about children and think about what they can remember. I also have a 5-year-old daughter, so I get to hear a lot of stories and I think about this stuff on a regular basis. There is, of course, there's quite a lot of research in that area. Although, again, it's going to depend on, so how recent it needs to be may depend on the type of event, the individual child, and whether the child comes from a family that talks about events a lot or not. So there's all these other factors. Of course, the more recent the event, the more likely they are to be able to talk about it and remember it. More distant events are going to be forgotten more. Salient events tend to be better remembered, you sort of unique events compared to events that are more mundane or more commonplace. But sometimes what's unique and special to us isn't always what's unique and special to them. We've taken our daughter to some places where I think, wow, this is amazing. And she doesn't really remember it, but then she remembers, you know, a time we went to the swimming pool and so something really important to her happened, you know? So there is research and there are parameters, but those parameters are kind of just anchors. I definitely agree with you that they, you know, sometimes they say they don't remember because they don't remember. They also, you know, don't remember because they don't want to do the talking, either because they're reluctant or because they're shy or because it's effortful and they don't want to do the work. So I do think there is value in finding an event that works for the child. And in speech pathology, I think you would have more luxury in how, you know, you can sort of kind of change the event until you get something that works with the child. Sometimes in investigative interviewing, we do, in advance of doing a forensic interview or an investigative interview with a child, it is recommended that interviewers spend about 3 to 5 minutes, roughly, talking about an unrelated pleasant event that the child can remember and talk about, just as you mentioned. So, you know, what they did on the weekend or what happened the last time they went to swimming lessons, which is a recurring event, and I'll come back to that. And so, you know, we don't want interviewers to spend 3 to 5 minutes choosing events and shuffling through events. I mean, of course, we don't want speech pathologists doing it either, but you might have a little bit more leeway to kind of try different events. So I think there's value in finding an event that works well. Try to pick something recent, if possible. Try to pick something that seems like it would be salient or meaningful. But let's come back to the topic of recurring events. So that's another area of research that has been, you know, really important to me and that I've done a lot of work in is children's autobiographical memory for these recurring events, for things that they do regularly, like swimming lessons, you know, soccer practice, football, that kind of thing, regular routine activities that happen sort of every week or so. So we've done some research on, you know, whether it's helpful for an investigative interview for these kids to be practicing in that early part of the interview, whether they talk about a repeated event and specific episodes or instances of that repeated event, or whether they talk about a single event, or whether they talk just generically about, you know, when I go to swimming lessons, when I do dance, this is what happens. Which, as you may know, kind of elicits a different type of memory, a more semantic memory, a more scripted memory that doesn't have those episodic features to it, the episodic reliving. It's not as detailed. It doesn't contain sort of memory for specific places and times and sensory experiences. We have found that there is some benefit of doing practice of you know, multiple episodes of a repeated event. So say the last time you went to swimming lessons and another time. But that benefit is kind of extends into the main part of the interview where we've seen that they will think more about the other interview topic. That would be their abuse allegations in the criminal sort of field. That they will think more about the fact that those are repeated, and they will be more likely to mention elements of the event being repeated, like saying that things were always the same or noticing differences between times, and just kind of alerting the interviewer spontaneously by having practiced talking about one repeated event and then coming to another repeated event. Their narrative has more markers in it that that the allegations are repeated. So that's very interesting. It's sort of a little bit of a training. You train them to think about these things. From a narrative, you know, development perspective, from a sort of training in speech pathology perspective, it may just be an interesting exercise, especially if you're working with a child on multiple, you know, multiple sessions. So trying to get a unique event one time, maybe trying to get some repeated events and just see how those different, how the child is able to cope with those different types of narratives.
Yeah, that's perfect. And we all know that we share personal narratives all the time, don't we? Whether it's in the classroom because a teacher asks you, what did you do on the weekend? Or whether it's journal writing, or whether it's talking to your friends or coming home from school and your parents asked you what happened. So it's not as if it's only applies to children who've been in really sort of, you know, abusive relationships or who've undergone trauma. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. Yeah. So let's move back to our asking better questions in healthcare. So my question to you is, are there really better questions?
Yeah. And I think that's a great question. It's one of those kind of it depends answers. I mean, we know that open-ended questions are kind of better than other questions for a variety of reasons. They elicit more accurate responses, as we've talked about. They tend to encourage more elaborate responses, you know, from many people, although not all respondents are able to cope with the broad open-ended questions. They're inherently supportive. Because they do put control of the conversation in the hands of the speaker or of the person that's being asked the questions. They really do give that respondent the opportunity to express themselves in their own words at their own pace, sharing parts of the story that they feel comfortable with in the order that they feel comfortable. So there are a lot of reasons why they are better questions than other types. And you know, so I think that's, we termed the course Asking Better Questions in Healthcare because of those features of the questions and because of the idea of really prioritizing that initial narrative and of getting as much spontaneous or with minimal prompting as possible before we start asking, you know, some more specific questions. So many professional groups, earlier I mentioned in one of my first examples, about a general practitioner or a medical professional asking about someone's experiences of, say, seizures or anxiety attacks. And, you know, eventually that medical professional is going to have to ask, how many times has this happened? And, you know, when did it happen last? And, or what other sensations are you experiencing? They're going to have to ask those questions, certainly. And so those questions are needed by some professional groups, but they are more error prone. They are, you know, less client centered. They don't invite narrative. They don't build narrative. So asking better questions in healthcare and thinking about open-ended questions as being those better questions prioritizes them in the conversation. And I think hopefully makes professionals think about front loading that conversation with those questions and then coming back to those other more specific questions that they may need, depending of course on the profession.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I actually, I did both of the courses, the children and the adult one. And I think one of the first exercises is that you've got to ask someone else to ask you questions. And one are sort of the more closed questions, even though we may not call all of them closed, you know, in that's what you've termed as closed. And the other one is more your open-ended questions. And then it asks you to reflect on how you felt. And interestingly, and that's my reflection, so I'm owning this, is that they took just as long. So it wasn't as if it was more time-consuming than the other one. But it actually felt like it was better for rapport building. The pace seemed to be much slower. And also, I was actually fine with producing more language or elaborating more. I felt more at ease. And so what I took away from that, and again, this is my personal reflection, is that we can use that, you know, with all our clients, whether it's with children or with adults, to sort of just sit back and go, okay. And it could be part of the rapport building exercise, or it could be when we ask children, oh, you know, what did you do at school today? Just take a step back and go, okay, how can I get the child to say more? How can I put them at ease? So it doesn't always have to be investigative, if that makes sense. That's definitely my takeaway message. And I do think they're better questions. So I agree with you. All right. What I'd like to do now is actually I'm going to ask you for your top tips, Sonia, for asking questions. So would you mind just sharing with me and the listeners some of your top tips?
Yeah, I think, we've talked most for the past half an hour about the value of open-ended questions. So I think that's a place to start. Is a top tip is try to keep your questions, certainly at the beginning, but as much as you can, as open as possible. So starting with that initial invitation, that first to tell me everything, that gives somebody an opportunity to share their story. And then from there, you know, using the breadth and depth prompts to build up, just to support the person in telling their story and to build it. And then even when you've come through to that point and you still have things that you want to follow up, there are still ways to keep questions as open as possible. So if we keep in mind those two principles of the open-ended questions, that they should encourage elaboration and that they should not constrain or dictate the content of the response, then we might, we may have some non-narrative follow-up questions we want to ask, but something like, tell me about the park is a good example. So this is a sort of an open-ended question, but it's not a narrative question. It doesn't promote a narrative. It promotes more of a description, but it's still very open because it could invite someone to tell you what the park looks like. It could invite someone to tell you where it is, their feelings about it or other experiences they've had with it. So it's still kind of open. And then from there, you know, when you're asking those WH questions, you can also reduce the specificity of them. You know, when was it, where was it, rather than what date, what address. You know, you're still kind of giving people that opportunity to provide a coarser grained response, a response that's at a level where they feel like they can provide the information accurately. So that would be the first one, is keep them as open as you can, even as you're working down and getting narrower. Also, of course, keeping your language as simple as you can. And this doesn't really matter who you're talking to. It doesn't matter if it's a 4-year-old or a 30-year-old or somebody from a vulnerable population or somebody who's maybe speaking English as a second or third language. You want to keep your words and your questions short and simple, of sort of avoiding jargon and really just kind of listening. Letting the person talk and listen to what they're saying. And that should help guide where your next question is. I mean, that's something that is a struggle for a lot of people who are learning to use more open-ended questions because they're thinking so much about the questions they want to use or that they should be using, that it's harder to listen. But I think when we do listen, we're able to ask better questions, questions that fit with the flow of the conversation, and that make the person feel heard and listened to.
Yes, thanks for that. I definitely agree. And just another thought came to me, Sonia, is that I think many of us, you know, in the speech pathology profession, well, we're all about communication. So I'd like to think that we're pretty good communicators. But what you said earlier really resonated with me. You know, it's the children or the adolescents or even the adults, you know, who've been exposed to people who talk to them, who reminisce about events that happened. Those are people who are the better, who are better able to share their own personal narratives. And there's lots and lots of research in that, you know, the importance of maternal, paternal reminiscing to support children's personal narrative development. And those effects are sort of enduring, you know, they're long-term, it sets you up for sharing experiences. So I think another really important takeaway message from just me talking to you is that we have an important role to play in educating others, you know, in how do I get more information from my child? You know, what sort of questions can I ask as a parent, as an educator, as, you know, as someone who spends a lot of time with the child? So what I really like is I sort of get this train the trainer feeling, you know, like this passing on the message, because communication really, as we've always said, is a basic human right. And it starts with talking about, you know, what makes us the way we are, you know, what is important to us and how can we share that information. So, so yes, again, that's what I'm taking away from just talking to you. So that's fantastic. So really my final question is, unless you want to provide any more information, I'll give you, you know, that question at the end. But a lot of people will say, oh, I'm very busy and doing another course, you know, it's just not on my agenda. Where can listeners go for more information in the first instance? If they say, look, this has really piqued my interest, you know, and I'm not quite ready perhaps to embark on another course, I've got no time or for whatever reason. Is there any information or a website that you could refer people to that might be of interest to them in the first instance?
Yeah, the Center for Investigative Interviewing that offers the course does have a website. Which is at investigativecenter.com. So investigative and then center all together. Center spelled C-E-N-T-R-E.com. So on the website, there is information about this course and other courses, as well as some more information about the people who work for the center. The courses that we offer, including Asking Better Questions in Healthcare, are all sort of based on the human learning principles of spaced learning and interactivity and immediate feedback. And what's important about that, the reason I bring it up is you know, you mentioned people trying to do the course and not having a lot of time and needing to do it in spare time, which is difficult. Or even if it is in work time, but not getting a lot of work time to do it. The courses are sort of meant to be spaced over time. They're meant to be things where you come and you learn a little bit, you go away, and you come back to it and look over things again and move forward. And the course is not particularly long. So because those spaced learning principles and interactivity and feedback are built right into it, it isn't something that you need to feel like you have to do in a few days, and you shouldn't do it in a few days. It's not the best way to promote deep learning. So I would encourage listeners to check out that website at investigativecenter.com for more information on the Asking Better Questions in Healthcare course, as well as any of the other courses.
Thank you so much for all the information that you've shared so far. Before we finish up, I would just like to invite you, is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation that we perhaps haven't covered?
Well, I would just say that I'd like to echo, you know, what you were talking about a few moments ago about speech pathologists having a kind of a train the trainer role, or to train children and families and educators and other people who work with kids to ask really effective questions to help children develop narrative skills, because the narrative skills underlie, you know, children and people's abilities to tell stories about their lives and to define kind of who they are and to work through their experiences. So I think as a train the trainer type model, this kind of training can be really useful for speech pathology in helping to develop the clients that they work with to the best of their potential.
Thanks, Sonia. Thanks again for, you know, making the time to meet with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast and share with your colleagues and friends. You can also visit us at speechpathologyaustralia.org.au. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.